From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this year, 1 hour after a six-month-old baby girl had gone to sleep. Her parents were downstairs, and at 7:30 p.m., they heard a moan and a cry that were unlike anything they were used to. They ran upstairs to find the infant, blank-faced, eyes open but distant, barely breathing. Mom breathed air into the baby's mouth. Dad called 911. What had happened? Well, they didn't know at the time. They worked on keeping the girl alive. After more assistance, the girl revived, and she was okay. She is still okay today. She's fine, more than okay. In fact, she's doing very well. Her mother, Jen Kaufman, wrote a piece about the experience for the Washington Post this week. The headline reveals the cause of her daughter's near-death experience. Here it is. A vaccine made my baby stop breathing. I still believe in vaccination. It turns out her daughter had suffered an extremely rare event, a side effect of vaccination so unusual that it barely registers in some research. You might think the mother turned against vaccines, but Kaufman says, to the contrary, it's just the opposite. She and her husband read the studies. They understood the numbers. Yes, in almost vanishingly rare cases, adverse reactions happen. But Kaufman writes the following, quote, I still have flashbacks to the night our daughter stopped breathing. When I thought we were losing her, I felt powerless. But I can't imagine the sorrow we would feel if she were to fall seriously ill from a preventable disease. Doing our best to keep our daughter safe is what we pledged to do when we became parents, and that we continue to ensure our daughter is vaccinated is an essential part of keeping that promise, end quote. This is a mother who understands the value of vaccines and hasn't decided that her singular case trumps decades of scientific evidence. But this month, listeners have urged me to check out what Dr. Jill Stein has been saying about vaccines. Stein is the Green Party candidate for president. This happens to be Vaccine Awareness Month, and our guests are here to answer our questions and discuss the latest on vaccination efforts. We'll also talk about new regulations, back to school, and more. Let me welcome our guests in studio. Dr. Michael Mendoza is here. He's the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County and the Medical Director of Highland Family Medicine. Dr. Mendoza, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Neil Herendeen's here. Dr. Herendeen's a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. And, Doctor, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And we're going to be, in just a moment, you're going to hear what Dr. Jill Stein said, the Green Party presidential candidate. You'll also hear what Donald Trump said in the debates last year. This is not, again, about asking our guests to weigh in on supporting or opposing candidates. Our guests are here with their expertise on a singular subject. That's it. So that's out of the way. For the background now, if you missed it, again, a lot of listeners said, listen to what Dr. Stein said. So let's listen. These are the comments of Dr. Jill Stein just a few weeks ago to the Washington Post. About 2.5 minutes, a long set of comments, but I want to play them in full. This is Dr. Stein of the Washington Post.
Okay, I think there's no question that vaccines have transformed public health and have been absolutely critical in ridding us of the scourge of many diseases, smallpox, polio, etc. So vaccines are an invaluable medication. Like any medication, they also should be, approved by a regulatory board that people can trust. And I think right now that is the problem, that people do not trust a Food and Drug Administration where you have the likes of, or even the CDC for that matter, where corporate influence and the pharmaceutical industry has a lot of influence, where, for example, Monsanto lobbyists help run the day in those agencies and are in charge of approving what food is or isn't safe. There is rampant distrust of our institutions of government right now. The trust level for the presidency is somewhere around 15%. The strong confidence in Congress is somewhere around 4%, and the same is true of our regulatory agencies. So our overarching solution here, you know, as a medical doctor, there was a time when I looked very closely at those issues, and not all those issues were completely resolved. There were concerns among physicians about what the vaccination schedule meant, the toxic substances like mercury, which used to be rampant in vaccines. There were real questions that needed to be addressed. I think some of them at least have been addressed. I don't know if all of them have been addressed. At the same time, we have a real compelling need for vaccinations. It requires an agency that we can trust to sort through all of those concerns, to assure the American public, whether it's vaccinations, whether it's administering estrogen to, treat symptoms of menopause, or at one point it was the solution to prevent Alzheimer's, and then it was discovered, oh my goodness, it may actually contribute to Alzheimer's. So it's really important that the American public have confidence in our regulatory boards so that all of our medical treatments and medications actually are approved by people who do not have a vested interest in their promotion. In my experience, this is not a radical idea. This is basic common sense.
So if you're wondering why some people have labeled Jill Stein an anti-vaxxer, that's why. That was not a full-throated endorsement of a vaccine schedule and the current system. She has tried to walk it back and say she doesn't understand why people are labeling her that way, but if you were wondering, that those were her comments. Now let's listen to what Donald Trump said about vaccines during the campaign. And again, why am I bringing up Jill Stein and Trump? Well, people have asked me to. Three of the four presidential candidates in the Libertarian, Green, Republican, and Democratic parties, three of the four have not supported the full schedule. Only Hillary Clinton has. This is Donald Trump during one of the debates about vaccines.
Mr. Trump, as president,
well,
as president, you would be in charge of the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health, both of which say you are wrong. How would you handle this as president?
Autism has become an epidemic. 25 years ago, 35 years ago, you look at the statistics, not even close. It has gotten totally out of control. I am totally in favor of vaccines, but I want smaller doses over a longer period of time. Because you take a baby in, and I've seen it, and I had my children taken care of over a long period of time, over a 2 or 3 year period of time, same exact amount. But you take this little beautiful baby and you pump, it looks just like it's meant for a horse, not for a child. And we've had so many instances, people that worked for me just the other day, 2 years old, 2.5 years old, a child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back and a week later got a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic. I only say I'm in favor of vaccines. Do them over a longer period of time, same amount.
Thank you.
Just in little sections.
Dr. Carson?
I think you're going to see a big impact on autism.
No, you're not. But anyway, that's Donald Trump speaking at one of the Republican debates and putting all kinds of factual errors out there. Let me ask our guest, Dr. Mendoza, let me start with you. You heard two of the different presidential contenders talking about vaccines, different kinds of comments. You want to work backwards? What do you make of what you heard?
Well, I first have to reflect on the importance of being mindful about looking at any kind of recommendation. But I think, you know, the comments made by these two presidential candidates, I think, is somewhat disappointing. It definitely goes against what we know in the scientific literature and certainly goes against what we've seen in practice. We've got many, many decades of success showing that immunizations save lives, prevent illnesses, and really it's a step in the wrong direction when it comes to public health.
Dr. Herendine?
And I think we have to listen to the part where we're talking about regulatory oversight of some of these newer vaccines and having some degree of trust in that system. So if we know people that are in those positions in the CDC working with immunizations, they didn't get there because they're looking to make money. So anybody working in the public sector that's going to take a position on behalf of the right thing for children is not in the back door making money off of vaccines with these companies. In fact, part of the reason the CDC has become such an important part of vaccine regulation is many vaccine companies stopped making the vaccines because they couldn't afford to defend themselves in the court systems for the few adverse effects that were out there. There were many lawsuits coming forward, and many of these companies said, in our big picture of what we do as a company, vaccines are just not important enough for us to continue to operate that. So we're kind of in a position where the government had to step in to guarantee that any malpractice, any lawsuits, any adverse effects would be in fact covered by the government, because we need these vaccines to continue to be produced. And essentially they're being produced at a pretty much a cost neutral basis. No one's making a lot of money off of vaccine research or bringing out the next vaccine to protect the public.
I want to bring up just a couple of specific points we heard there. And I don't mean to sound exasperated about the vaccines and autism stuff. It's just been so discredited and so often brought up that to hear a presidential candidate of any party talking about a single case in which they claim to see. It is reckless. But let's ask a specific question separately about what Mr. Trump said. He said the amount of vaccine that looks like it's made for a horse. Dr. Mendoza, you sort of winced when you heard that. I don't know what he's talking about other than to say to him it looks he's uncomfortable with what infants are given, or maybe some parents have said that it looks like it's a lot or a big dose for a small child. What do we need to know about that?
You know, these vaccines have been tested and tested and given to hundreds of thousands of kids over many years. You know, the thought that these are enough to provide to a horse, it just tells me that, it's a background that's not really founded in any kind of scientific evidence whatsoever.
Dr. Herendeen?
Well, the vaccine schedule has changed over the years, and we're certainly vaccinating for more things than we did in the past. One of the regulations that we have and one of the difficulties with vaccines is we'd like to combine them together into a single shot, but the standards are such that right now, in order to bring a new vaccine out, you have to show that it's as good as if it was given by itself. So the few vaccines that we have been able to combine into a single shot were those that actually adding extra antigens, adding extra vaccines into a single shot did not decrease its effectiveness. So it's being more and more difficult to say, especially for the one-year visit, I always tell is our hardest visit right now, because in many practices we're giving 4, 5, sometimes 6 shots at that single one-year-old visit. And that seems like a lot. When we've actually done the studies, and some of the studies were done here back in the 90s, who has the biggest difficulty with giving more than 3 shots at a single visit? It's the doctors and the nurses, much more than the parents. So no. In our practice, parents were not balking at the 5th and the 6th shot.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, I thought you were going in a different direction, because my son is 4. I have been told I cannot be in the room just because, in the early cases, kids sometimes cry at shots. My son is such a warrior now with these, no big deal. He knows he's getting ice cream afterwards. And he just toughs it out. And he'll say afterwards, he goes, Dad, that wasn't that bad. Of course, I was in the other room. So I thought you were going to say it's harder for the parents sometimes than the kids, which can be true. Mm-hmm. But I take your point about the doctors as well. The bottom line is, when it comes to those single shots, the research shows this is not a horse quantity. This is a child quantity. And it's been tested. Yes?
And over the years, the antigens, the amount of impurities that have been in those vaccines have been vastly reduced. So the vaccine that you and I got when we were growing up, take the DPT shot, for example, that was a whole cell vaccine. They took the entire bacteria, killed it, and then put it in the vaccine. And what we found was lots of fevers, lots of irritability, lots of reactions the night after the shot. By taking only a small portion of the bacteria and putting that in the vaccine, you can eliminate a lot of side effects without reducing the effectiveness of the vaccine.
Listeners, if you have any questions or comments, we're going to be talking about back to school and Vaccine Awareness Month. You got anything on vaccines, call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. Dr. Stein also said she thinks there are still legitimate questions that need answers when it comes to two different things. Regulatory, Dr. Herendeen, you mentioned some of your thoughts on that. She also said the schedule, she kind of talked about spreading it out. But my understanding is the research indicates spreading out a schedule does not provide any more general safety. Is that correct, Dr. Mendoza?
That's correct. I think there's, while I can understand the desire to want to stretch things out, I would consider that really only a risk that is not borne with any benefit. I would say get it over with, frankly. The sooner you get it done with, as long as it's within the intervals that are recommended by the CDC, as a parent, I just want to get it over with and move on.
Dr. Herendeen?
Well, some of the scheduling actually looks at both the effectiveness of the vaccine and then the practicality of how can we actually deliver that vaccine to the greatest number of children in a schedule that makes sense. So when we're looking at what age to start a vaccine, what is the most immunologically makes sense, but also from a practical standpoint, how can we get this many children in the Rochester region all vaccinated on time? We kind of look at, what other things are going on? How often are they coming into the doctor's office anyway? If they're going to come in at 12 months and 15 months, are you going to add 3 more visits in between that so we give individual shots? Or are you going to say, it looks like this combination can be safely given together, and therefore you save yourself the trouble of coming back to the doctor's office, coming in the time for the nurses and the doctors to prepare the shots to give the vaccine. So trying to just be practical in the efficient way of getting the greatest number of children vaccinated, we try to build it into existing schedules.
All right. And then one more question on Dr. Stein. We're going to move on to other related issues to vaccines. During a Reddit conversation online in May, Dr. Stein also talked about why some people, she thinks, distrust vaccines. And she wrote on Reddit, quote, "Regulatory agencies are routinely packed with corporate lobbyists and CEOs, so the foxes are guarding the chicken coop as usual in the U.S. Who wouldn't be skeptical?" And, you know, I mean, I all of the, again, in the analysis I found, finds that most of the people on these regulatory boards are scientists, public health experts. She's making it seem like it's a bunch of Monsanto folks, you know, who are greasing the skids for some profit machine. And Dr. Mendoza, I suspect you're an evidence person as well. Is there evidence that there's something to be worried about there?
I am not aware of any evidence to support the remarks that Dr. Stein made. And I would add that, you know, any healthcare professional who's in the business of providing vaccinations to children are looking at the recommendations themselves. You know, we practice these days in an era when we look at evidence. We have access to the evidence, and we're very discerning about these things. And the last thing we want to do is cause harm to our children. And so whether it's a medication or a vaccination or a treatment or a surgery, you know, we're in the business and we are very experienced in talking through the risks and the benefits with our patients. And frankly, when it comes to immunizations, it's a very easy conversation. The risks are just not there and the benefits are huge.
Yeah, and Dr. Herendeen, like you said, if you want to make money in medicine, vaccines is a terrible place to go.
Right. And I think I'd like to clarify the evidence-based medicine.
Yeah.
Because I think we throw that term out in thinking that all medicine has an evidence base that we can understand and make the best decision. Well, there's many things that the evidence is not clear-cut. It's not that we have 50 years of experience. And there's even conditions that we have 50 years of experience that the evidence changes over time as our understanding changes. So things as simple as strep throat are still talked about in the medical literature. We're still having studies about strep throat. And you'd think that after 45 years of the same recommendations, no one would ever challenge that. Even for vaccines, we've been giving Tylenol and ibuprofen and medications to decrease fever associated with vaccines at the time or prior to getting the shot. Well, it turns out after 40 years of doing that, the immunogenicity, the response to the vaccine, is reduced a little bit if you give Tylenol before you get the shot. So now the recommendation is give it an hour, let the child start to get a little bit of response, then reduce the fever, then reduce the side effects, if in fact they come. And it turns out for young children, the toddlers, it's only about 20% of kids will mount a fever response to their vaccine. So you can reduce a lot of unnecessary Tylenol and ibuprofen use if you, in fact, wait to see what the child's response actually is.
All right. Emails and comments on Twitter are rolling in. We're going to get to those with our guests. And if you want to call the program as we talk about vaccines, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jill writes to the program and wants to know, how do your guests suggest we eradicate the autism BS dealing with them? How do we move on from this place where vaccines are questioned instead of how we improve science in general? Dr. Mendoza?
Well, that's a tough one because, you know, from my standpoint, I would have thought that we'd be there by now. And unfortunately, we're not. And we have some very vocal celebrities and politicians and others who are not yet on the bandwagon. And, you know, it's going to be a tough problem. But, you know, you don't want to fight misinformation with more misinformation. So from my standpoint, you know, we do what we can, making sure that we share accurate information and hope for the best. But honestly, when it comes down to talking to the public here in Monroe, in the county, in our offices, in our primary care practices, you know, we just want to tell people, you know, what we know is true and let the message speak for itself.
Dr. Herendeen?
And the way you stop the misinformation is you come up with the answer. Well, we don't have that answer yet. We're still doing a lot of research. Rochester has one of the autism centers within the country. So we have a lot of active researchers looking at links, causes, and some of our current understanding is most of our genetic predisposition towards having autism probably occurs in utero. And then there's some other event or experience after birth that adds to that link and that risk of developing autism. But there are so many things that a child experiences in those first 2 years of life. And typically we're not labeling a child with autism until we start to see the social interactions, until we start seeing some of the features at 15, 18, 24 months. So the labeling, the diagnoses, makes it much more difficult when you have a condition that is not evident at birth. This is not a heart attack. This is not a heart disease. This is not a study or test that we can show is there or is not there. It's something that evolves, and there's so many different levels of involvement that this presentation of autism can be very subtle in those early years, that to say it's a cause and effect, we're still trying to put together, let's look at all the potential possibilities, including the vaccine schedule, if that happens to be one. But so far, vaccines are not turning into be a triggering event to then become autistic.
And, you know, what worries me, Dr. Herendeen, is that even with evidence, these are issues that are hard to move some people. You know, Brendan Nyhan and some others have studied very specifically how people understand vaccines and public health. And even with evidence, it doesn't always move them, which is a big concern. But I agree with you that hopefully with more information, better information, that will move the needle anyway.
Well, is your evidence coming from a scientific study or is it coming from a blog?
Well, no.
Just because it's even in print good information, doesn't
make it real. No, I understand. But Nyhan is a researcher who just wanted to know, you know, when you give people who have suspicions, sort of Jill Stein conspiracy theories about vaccines, and that is there a way to move people? And in general, sometimes presenting actual factual evidence moves people in the opposite direction, which is an amazing thing. Listeners, again, I'm going to kind of keep getting through your comments. Some of you have questions about specific vaccines, which we can try to get hit. Some are more general. Heidi writes to the program and just wants to know if our guests are hearing any pushback because of the presidential candidates. I don't know if you are, but let me broaden Heidi's question. Are you getting any pushback or concern from parents based on any public figures, whether it's celebrities, presidential candidates, et cetera? Dr. Mendoza?
You know, I think a lot of my patients will ask me, oh, I heard so-and-so celebrity say this or that, and I welcome those questions. I think that's an opportunity to clarify misinformation. You know, I would much rather somebody come in and say, hey, I found this on the internet. Tell me more about this, because it's a doorway into, you know, better understanding. So, you know, while it takes more time, while I wish I didn't have to, you know, clarify that misinformation, you know, if that misinformation is out there, I welcome the chance to clear it up.
Dr. Herendeen?
Nothing recently that's escalated because of the election process. So
that's true.
I think there's some distrust out there, but we've always had.
Okay. And I'm looking at the CDC's vaccination rates. And guys, please tell me if I'm wrong here. I'm looking at percentage of children 19 to 35 months old receiving vaccinations. And the combined seven vaccine series, they've got at 71.6%. First of all, how do we do locally? How is Western New York doing in terms of, from best you can tell, how are we doing in terms of vaccination, you know, schedules, completion, et cetera?
So I've seen the data just for the University of Rochester practices, which includes our practice at the hospital and others, that we're much, much better than that. And we've had a big effort over the years to deliver vaccines. So it's not just about recommending the vaccine. It's how do you actually get the child in for that full series to finish it by the time they turn 24 months. So our rates currently within the university are up closer to 90%. For that initial seven doses or seven vaccines in the first 2 years of life.
And that's been my experience at our office as well. So I have to wonder, you know, we're doing well with the kids that we see, but, you know, part of the goal of public health is trying to reach out to those kids that we don't see. And I have to believe that that's the reason why the rates, as you've mentioned them, seem so low.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the assumptions I would have would be that people who aren't getting vaccinated, kids who aren't getting vaccinated, may come from poverty. Maybe parents don't have access, et cetera. But here's a study published in the January issue of the American Journal of Public Health using California state government data regarding personal belief exemptions. And they found that the people most likely to refuse to have their children vaccinated tend to be white and rich.
Well, I used to work in San Francisco, and I saw a fair amount of that. And I have to say that the prevalence of that here in this community is far less than I experienced back in the Bay Area, for sure.
Interesting.
There's definitely a regional approach to that. So I think we've been having a lot of efforts, a lot of information, a lot of dedication of the practitioners in this area that believe in vaccines have been trying to get that out. Dr. Peter Szilagyi was the division chief of general pediatrics for years, recently moved out to California to be with family and took his project, which he's been getting outreach workers to get immunization rates. He's kind of taken across the inner city access to care and really brought those immunization rates up equal to our suburban communities, and went out to UCLA, where he found 50% of those kids in the practice at UCLA are not vaccinated by intention. It's not because of lack of access to care. It's not because they don't come for their visits. It's parents choosing not to vaccinate.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour and your phone calls when we come back. So Jennifer, Allison, John, we're coming to you on the phones. We've got more of your comments and questions that have come in via email on vaccines as well. It's Vaccine Awareness Month, and we've got Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County and the Medical Director of Highland Family Medicine, as well as Dr. Neil Herendeen, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Let's get this very short break and come right back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, our first hour, preempted by special NPR national coverage of Hillary Clinton's proposals and policy on economics. You heard Donald Trump earlier this week. Hillary Clinton gets the spotlight on Thursday. In our second hour, another in our series of conversations we call the Summer of Food on Connections, putting the spotlight on the agriculture scene in Western New York. Talk to you then. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Jennifer is in Henrietta. First up, go ahead, Jennifer.
Question about why we would start vaccinating newborns in the hospital for hepatitis B when it's, you know, the mothers are negative and it's a disease that's spread by blood and body fluid transmission. Kind of wondering why we'd have to vaccinate a newborn in the hospital for that.
Okay, Jennifer, stay on the line, and we'll let our doctors respond to that. Dr. Herendeen, go ahead.
So, Jennifer, I actually had a very similar opinion about 6-7 years ago when the state decided that this was their way of making sure all children were protected against hepatitis B. And part of the reasoning behind that was, I agree with you, if you are screened in your OB, you know you don't have hepatitis B, you're not a carrier, then your child is at very, very, very low risk of transmitting that, picking it up in the first 2 months of life. And what we'll do is we'll get to your vaccination at the routine schedule at 2, 4, and 6 months. What was happening was not all women are appropriately screened for hepatitis B, and that information coming from the private OB's office into the hospital record, there was 3 cases within 3 years that a child was not appropriately vaccinated, was not given the immune globulin at the earliest possible exposure to a mother that did in fact have hepatitis B. And the state was basically saying, I don't know of a full safe way to say that all children will always be protected unless we go to universal screening right off the bat. So as much as we'd like to say out of the 100,000 births in the New York State area that all 100,000 children will be adequately screened and treated right away, this was the state's way of saying, just in case the paperwork doesn't go through, somebody transmits a plus sign from a minus sign off of a chart, that doesn't in fact allow a child to then have devastating complications from hepatitis. So our practice did, I think we were the last ones in Monroe County that agreed to say, yes, let's vaccinate right in the nursery and get started there.
I work in one of the hospitals, and I know with everything's on the computer now. If it's not, if we don't have a record in the computer that the mother's negative, we test her in the hospital, do the rapid test, and get the results before the baby goes home. So I'm still kind of, I have a hard time recommending it to, you know, say, oh, yeah, go ahead, because we have the record. I mean, I've heard that argument before. I just kind of don't, with everything on the computer now, it's like somebody's mistranscribing something. You know what I mean?
And that happens, and that's part of the trouble is the accuracy of the medical record is not 100%. And in fact, this wasn't a theoretical risk. It was actually 3 cases that happened 3 years in a row. So we're trying to really shore up as much as we can to prevent vaccine-preventable diseases.
And again, if I could just add on to that, you know, we build healthcare systems and clinical systems, you know, around the presumption that we don't always have all the information perfect at every time. And so, you know, when we institute a universal quote-unquote recommendation, the hope really is to do as much as you possibly can to eliminate any risk, and particularly when we're talking about a vaccine that really carries no risk to the child and only benefit, you know, the risk-benefit really, you know, weighs in favor of giving all these kids a vaccine.
Jennifer?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the
thanks,
phone call.
Jennifer.
We appreciate that. Thank you, Jennifer. In Canandaigua, this is Allison next up. Go ahead, Allison.
Yes, just a quick comment on the whole revolving door scene between industry and regulatory agencies. I just wanted to comment that as an Obama fan, I was very, very disappointed when one of his first appointments was Michael Taylor, who is a perfect example of one who has gone back and forth several times between industries such as Monsanto and the regulatory agency. So I just wanted to put that in the record. Thanks.
All right, Allison, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. Let me read an email from Tim in Pittsburgh. Tim writes, quote, "It makes me nervous when a presidential candidate doesn't trust the CDC and then states that the general public doesn't either. She is doing a disservice to the average citizen and to conspiracy theorists who think that the government and a group of doctors are somehow trying to kill us off. How ridiculous." That's from Tim in Pittsburgh. Differing opinions. But Tim, I appreciate that as well. Back to your phone calls. Let me get John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, my question is in regards to the flu vaccine. I've read some studies and opinions from doctors who have said that the flu vaccine really isn't effective, that the percentage of people that get the flu after they get the vaccine isn't that much different than people that don't get the vaccine. What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for your question. That's a good question. The flu vaccine, as you may know, is a vaccine that's produced every year, and it's essentially based on a global prediction of which strains are going to be relevant in any given season. And in some years, we get it right. I think the last flu season, the experience has been that the flu vaccine was highly protective, highly effective against the clinical illnesses in the flu. The previous year was not so much. And, you know, but every year it's a little
because
bit
because it mutates?
They call it antigenic drift. It's basically mutations. And you just can't know which strain is going to hit the world in any given year.
John?
All right. Yeah. I got to tell you, I've never had the flu vaccine, and I haven't had flu in, I think, 40 years.
Yeah, but you don't think that you're,
I know,
that you're
a
scientific
anecdotal
study, do you? Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But I do know people that swear by the vaccine, and sometimes they still get the flu. But, you know, I'm just basing upon a couple of studies that I've read and a couple of doctors' opinions that I've read also. Well, so there's some truth to it, but it depends.
It depends on the year. John, thanks for the phone call. And as Dr. Mendoza said, that's a question we've heard on this program a number of times. But again, they're doing the best they can in the medical community to sort of gauge what we're going to see with flu. And a couple of winters ago was kind of rough, but this past year much better. Dr. Herendine, you want to weigh in there?
We do have a new update for this coming flu season.
Okay.
And that last year's nasal spray of the flu vaccine for pediatrics turned out not to be as protective as we wanted. So the recommendation this year is there'll be no nasal spray flu vaccine for children.
Which we've had to disappoint my son with.
And that's why I'm saying it now,
yes.
Because if you come in the doctor's office in October and you suddenly get surprised that it's only going to be the shot version, a lot of kids are going to be unhappy with us. So we're trying to get that message out that we'll have plenty of flu vaccine, but it will be in the shot version for children this year.
Okay, well, speaking of children this year, we're in back-to-school mode. I'm sorry, it's true. A lot of people are getting ready for back-to-school in about a month. And what should people know about vaccine schedules, the requirements for parents, maybe new regulations, anything out there? Dr. Herendine?
So the new regulation that was talked about in January law took effect that meningitis vaccine is going to be a mandatory vaccine for children at ages 12 and 17 this year. So as children are getting ready to enter 7th grade and 12th grade, they should have evidence of having two doses of the vaccine for the older kids and the initial dose for the 11 and 12-year-olds. Now, that's not a big change for most practices because I can't remember the last patient that actually said, I don't want the meningitis vaccine. When you explain what it is, when you explain what it protects, almost everybody in our practice is like, yes, we want that. So meningitis is a spinal fluid infection. It can infect the brain. And in Rochester area, we get about 3 or 4 cases per year. And every time it happens, it hits the news. So you'll hear Dr. Mendoza talking probably in the next 3 months that there's been another case of meningococcal meningitis in our area. But that's really all we're talking, 3 or 4 cases throughout all of Rochester. But if you're that one child out of our area and it's something you can prevent, then it's worth a lot of effort on my part to make sure that doesn't happen to anybody in my practice. So the causes of meningitis, there's different strains, just like with the flu, there's different strains. There's actually 5 strains of meningococcal disease out there. The Menactra Menvio vaccine has 4 of those strains. There is a brand new 5th strain vaccine out there. So meningitis B now has 2 companies that have made a vaccine to protect against that 5th strain. That is not part of the mandatory vaccination, but it is offered for 16 to 18 year olds. So if you're getting ready to go off to college, most likely you'll be offered your 2nd dose of the 4-valent meningitis vaccine, and then you'll also be offered a separate meningitis B vaccine. And our recommendation is to get all of those because, again, your highest risk is older teenagers, kids in college, kids going off to the military, kids living in group situations. And the hardest part with meningitis disease is it starts out with the flu. You have a headache, you have a fever, you don't feel well, and it progresses so quickly that by the next morning can kill you. So it's a very difficult bacteria to treat on our part. And the horror stories that we hear about it are kids that had a mild fever, headache, and then quickly got sick, even in the hospital, weren't able to save them. So we want to try to do everything we can to prevent those getting struck by lightning type of diseases.
All right, parents, a good thing to keep in mind there. Any other changes or anything else we should know for parents? Otherwise, same kind of schedule, same kind of planning?
Same schedule. Still need your tetanus shot to get into 6th grade. Some of the schools are going to get a little stricter about exactly when you have to have that vaccine in. So in previous years, we've had a lot of school nurses like, you know, if you get your vaccine sometime in September and October, you're still good. I heard one school last year that you had to have it within the first week of school opening. And remember, there's some of our urban charter schools that are starting in August. So they're starting August 20th, August 21st. It's not just after Labor Day. So you may be faced with trying to get in for that last vaccine quickly before the start of school.
So it's really never too early to reach out to your pediatrician, family physician, make an appointment, not only to get the vaccinations, but to do all the relevant health screening that is really important as we look to the new year. You know, and just a reminder, the Monroe County Health Department also offers immunizations. We have walk-in clinics you can call, make an appointment. MonroeCounty.gov/health is where you can find that information. But, you know, really the best place to go is to your local physician and get more than the vaccines, but get the relevant health screening as well.
Melissa writes to the program and wants to know if religious exemptions are still allowed.
Yes.
So the religious exemption clause has been hotly debated, and each state is re-looking at their ruling for that. So the paperwork, the requirement can be from the New York State. It's the education department that sets up the rules about exclusion based on religion. Some of the states are now pushing towards only having a medical exemption. New York State has not approved that legislation, but it has been talked about within the legislation in the last year.
It was just over a year ago that we had a downstate assemblyman, I don't know if it was Jeff Dinowitz, there was a downstate assemblyman who's pushed a bill that would essentially put New York in position to be where I think California, I want to say it's West Virginia and one other, that banned religious exemptions. At the time, a year ago, there was only about 3 states that banned religious exemptions. And as Dr. Herendeen said, allowed for medical exemptions only. And that bill, to my knowledge, has not passed or gone anywhere in the New York State Legislature. It's probably one of those bills that may come up on an annual basis. But again, to our knowledge, it's no movement yet on that.
No change from previous years.
Okay. In the medical community, do you stay out of that? Or you don't have to answer this if you don't like, but I'll ask you, do you want to see that kind of legislation pass?
I think for our sake, the exemption rules that are currently in place do respect parents' choices to allow to vaccinate or not. There's a lot of debate within pediatricians' offices even about if you have a child that's not vaccinated, are they placing your other patients in the waiting room at risk for possibly bringing in measles, mumps, a condition that everyone else should have been vaccinated for? And it's not healthy children that we're worried about. It's our immune compromised patients that are in the office. And you can't tell who's immunocompromised, who's not, who's at risk, who's not. So in the big picture, our practice at Strong, we feel very comfortable that we want patients to be vaccinated. But if you haven't been vaccinated, we still want you to get the medical care and come talk to us about which vaccines you may or may not be willing to do. If you then get to school age, you have to understand that if your child is sick with any of those diseases or anyone else in the school gets a case of chickenpox, your child's going to be asked to leave the school until all of that illness is out of the school. So it may actually mean less attendance in school, not because your child's sick with it, but because someone in the school has a disease that could potentially harm your child. So it kind of goes both ways of not necessarily worrying so much about whether my child's going to be the cause of other kids getting sick, but it may actually exclude your child from school activities because someone in the school picked up whooping cough.
Yeah, it was on this program where we talked to a woman who calls herself a vaccine rights attorney last year for this conversation. And I felt like it was a little bit of a bait and switch because she had sort of advertised her work representing clients, parents who didn't want their kids vaccinated on the grounds that, sort of libertarian grounds, that we don't like the government telling you you must do X, Y, and Z with your children's bodies. She got on this program and she said, no, vaccines just don't work. She said vaccines didn't even cure polio. And that's when I had one of my weaker moments and told her I sort of regretted having her on because I just did not expect that. Hmm. We know the vaccines did an amazing work with polio, right? I mean, that's not really even debatable.
It's not debatable.
But to answer the question, Melissa, we don't exactly know, what exactly is going to happen in the New York State legislature with religious exemptions, but they are currently still on the table in this state. Also, another question from a listener about HPV. We actually had a couple of emails about HPV, about, essentially people saying, I hear a lot. People who hear concerns about vaccines often hear it directed at HPV for various reasons. Can it be trusted? What do we know about it, et cetera? Dr. Herendeen?
So I like the HPV question, partly because the HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus, was developed here in Rochester. So even though a lot of people say, well, it's a brand new vaccine, I haven't heard anything about it, at Strong Memorial Hospital, the researchers that developed this knew about this vaccine many, many years. There's a lot of time, a lot of effort placed into vaccine trials, patients that have had all three doses, the sequence of dosing, how many doses are effective. A lot of that research was actually done here. So when we came out with the vaccine, we actually got a call from the CDC that said, what age should we start introducing this vaccine? And my answer was, well, what age are children sexually active? Because this is a sexually transmitted disease. Unfortunately, in our practice at Strong, we see 12-year-olds each and every year that get pregnant. So we know there's sexual activity that comes far, far before what you would otherwise think. And we said, you need to start this at age 11. And that was the reason that the vaccine companies actually did their trials on 10 and 11-year-olds to start the series. It turns out after 10 years of the vaccine, it was a good decision because now we know that the vaccine titers, the actual protectiveness, is better if you get it at 11 and 12 than it is if you take it at 17, 18, 19. So getting the vaccine earlier gives longer immunity, higher protection, and this is not a disease like meningitis that's a once-in-a-lifetime hit in the sky with lightning. This is one out of every two 18 to 25-year-olds will pick up one of these HPV vaccines, and there's a whole series of vaccines, titers, and strains that come out with HPV. So your adolescent, your young adult has a 1 in 2 chance of being exposed, but that does not mean they have a 1 in 2 chance of developing cancer because of HPV. That's only certain strains and certain conditions that set you up for that level of infection causing cancer down the road. But this is our very first cancer vaccine. And that's the real reason we're excited about it and pushing for it is if we can eliminate cervical cancer and certain anal cancers and throat cancers because of this vaccine, the world is going to be a much safer, better place 30 years from now.
Okay. Dr. Mendoza, co-sign?
Absolutely. No, it's exciting. I mean, this is a cancer prevention maneuver. We're not just talking about a day or a week of feeling crummy at home. This is preventing anal, throat, and cervical cancer. And I can't think of a better public health win if we can actually crack this one.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray on Twitter directs us to a really cool chart here from the American Academy of Pediatrics, a history of vaccines going back to the 1700s on how medicine was approaching these things. And 1777, Benjamin Jesty discovers contracting cowpox makes one immune to smallpox and inoculates his family with cowpox, performing the first known vaccination. And then you can go by the century, the 1800s, the early 1900s, and then by the decade all the way up until now. Dr. Murray, thank you for this. Megan Mack and I will post this on our Twitter feeds if you want to check it out. It's just easy to digest and a great way to look at the history. And I should ask both of our guests here, how do you view Rochester's place in the history of vaccines, research and development and whatnot? Dr. Mendoza?
Well, you know, Dr. Herendeen mentioned Gardasil. I think that's a great example of how the University of Rochester and our scientific community and our public health community here in Rochester are really leading the way. You know, I'm very proud of the work that's going on here, both within the healthcare systems as well as in the communities and public health. So I think in many ways we're leading the charge, and I think the outcomes show it. You know, when you look at the national outcomes in terms of chronic illness and cost of care, you know, our community does exceedingly well. And so I think that's something we all have to take deep pride in.
Dr. Herendeen?
And there's tricks to vaccines. So there's children that won't develop a response to a vaccine because they're just too young. Their immune systems aren't ready to respond to that unless you present it to the body in a specific way. So the Haemophilus type B vaccine first came out for 15 to 18-month-olds. And all of us were excited, but we also knew we were missing 75% of the kids that actually got Haemophilus type B were the under one-year-olds. So it was kind of when the vaccine first came out, it's like, this is great. However, we got a long ways to go because until we can get that vaccine in a two-month-old and get it to work, we're missing our real opportunity to prevent disease. So my daughter is now 30, just had her own baby. She was one of those early subjects that participated trying to get the vaccine to respond to younger and younger children. And I think the Rochester community has been wonderful, not just the researchers, but the community that's willing to put themselves out there and say, I understand the risks of this infection. I want my child to participate. I want to see if we can improve things. There's been HIV trials going on in Rochester for years now. And I'm always impressed by the number of people that anything that they can do to further the investigation to hopefully find the cure, they're willing to be part of that with some trepidation, but it's that level of trust with the Rochester area that we're not taking unnecessary chances. We have a very careful human subjects board that reviews every one of these trials to make sure that no unnecessary risk is ever being taken to try to develop a new vaccine or a new medication that might be helpful. So it's a very safety-conscious effort in the Rochester region.
And now that you mentioned 30-year-olds, I think it's important to point out that vaccines they aren't just for kids. You know, we look at the flu vaccine for adults, Zostavax to help prevent post-herpetic neuralgia, the pneumococcal vaccines for pneumonia illness. There are a whole host of tetanus and pertussis. I mean, these are vaccine-preventable illnesses for adults as well. And, you know, you might ask yourself as a healthy adult, why is this important for me? You know, the reality is that as healthy adults, we sometimes have small children in our home. We have elderly. We have other loved ones who may be struggling through cancer and other conditions that make them at greater risk. And so vaccines aren't just for kids.
Email from a listener who did not leave a name but wants to know, what about getting children tested for exposure to lead hazards? I don't know exactly the context or the framing here, but Dr. Mendoza?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the connection between immunizations and lead is, except to say that, you know, we do want to screen all kids for lead once before age one and again before age two, because we know that lead is prevalent in our community in the housing stock. And it's particularly prevalent in the inner city, where we know that homes have higher concentrations of lead, and through a lot of work happening in the community through the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning and a collaboration with the city and the county, you know, we've made great strides in improving lead in our community, and there's still a lot more to go. There's also a lot of attention to the water, which, you know, is, you know, driven in part by attention in Flint and other places. But, you know, every time we've looked here in our community, our water is safe. And, you know, I think it's important to be aware of lead, but largely so that we pay attention to where the problem is. It's in the housing stock in our city. And to make sure that kids get tested appropriately.
And because I've got about 80 seconds left, let me just follow up real briefly on that, because this led a whole other discussion. But do you think Flint has at least sharpened the focus in communities across the country to make sure, to check and to double check and to make sure that water source, we could talk about paint, and that's obviously been an ongoing battle locally, mm-hmm. but has Flint at least pushed communities to be very, very certain about water?
I think so, and it's a good thing. I mean, you hate to have a tragedy like this happen anywhere, but to the extent that there might be a silver lining in this, you know, I think it's pushed us all to be a little bit more thoughtful and to find some reassurance that we've been on the right track for a long time here.
Well, we didn't have time to get to some listeners' questions. They want to know if our guests think that we should be able to fire patients for refusing vaccines. Well, that'll have to be another hour. We've talked about that on previous programs, and I know it can be hot button, but let me just ask this, and Dr. Herendeen, just some final quick thoughts. We got about 30 seconds. Some final thoughts for listeners on vaccines and schedules. Go ahead.
So I'll not fire any patients. I always like to keep them involved and entertained.
Me neither.
But the schedules are there. The change is all the time. So even when I'm training the next generation of pediatricians, I'm telling them don't memorize the schedule. Go look it up each year. If there's subtle changes, if there's new vaccines. And every time I tell a 12-year-old, you're done with your vaccines, unless they come out with a new one. So I've stopped telling kids that they've completed their vaccine series.
Don't ever tell them that.
I want to thank our guest for the hour, Dr. Neil Herendeen, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Thank you, doctor. Great having you here. And Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County and the Medical Director of Highland Family Medicine. Dr. Mendoza, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks very much, Evan.
It's Vaccine Awareness Month here, and hopefully you got a lot of good information for you and your family. And to my son, if you were listening, maybe riding in the car with mom, sorry about the flu vaccine. No nasal stuff this year. It's going to have to be a shot, but you know what? I know you can do it. You always surprise me. I'm the weak one in this relationship. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. Deprina Godboldo, the intern. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.